This is James Coover with K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District with your Extension Crop Report. The days are getting warmer and all of nature is preparing for spring. Wheat fields are starting to push out and leaves are getting longer. Jointing is not far away, if it's not here already. This is where the growing point on each tiller starts to move from the crown and up the stem. However, this is also the time of year where farmers start to notice that some wheat isn't growing as well as the rest of the field. Patches or stripes of yellow wheat become apparent, and farmers start to wonder, why is my wheat yellow? There are a number of problems that can cause yellow wheat. Many are caused by lack of nutrients or root growth, while others are caused by insects and diseases. And it is possible that herbicides or fertilizers can be to blame as well. Sometimes the issue is obvious, but more often the underlying cause is hidden. A very common reason for yellowing wheat is nitrogen or sulfur deficiency. This causes a general yellowing of old leaves and nitrogen deficiency, and more in the newer leaves and sulfur deficiency. It is more likely in wet years, but can happen in nearly every year. Depending on the weather, it is easily possible to happen in fields that have been top-dressed with plenty of nitrogen or sulfur fertilizers as well. Nitrogen deficiency yellowing will be a big sweeping areas over a field. The field edges and within the tire tracks of fertilizer spreader could tend to stay a darker green. In properly fertilized fields, this yellowing will usually clear up as the wheat roots grow to match the quickly expanding tillers. Nutrient deficiency can also be caused by poor root growth as well. And poor root growth is caused by a number of physical problems in the soil itself. This can be a heavy plow pan, the lack of drainage in areas, or even a pH that is acidic enough to restrict root growth from iron toxicity. Now for the biotic side of things. Wheat viruses start to show up in full force this time of year. In this area, the most common wheat viruses is soil-borne mosaic, which is spread by swimming fungal spores in the soil, and barley yellow dwarf, which is spread by aphids in the fall. The soil-borne mosaic virus causes wheat leaves to be splotchy and stunted. However, the virus starts to deactivate when temperatures get above 68 degrees. Barley yellow dwarf shows up about now and can be seen with a purple-reddish coloring at the end of leaves. Both diseases will affect small patches of wheat throughout a field, with mosaic viruses following wet areas while the barley yellow dwarf being more random. Keep in mind that while aphids do spread the barley yellow dwarf this time of year, it is too late for new infections of the virus to cause much harm. Speaking of aphids, major outbreaks of aphids can also cause yellowing as well. It takes quite a bit of aphids to be a problem, and they shouldn't be hard to find at this population level. I've seen a lot of ladybugs out already taking care of the problem for us. Fungal diseases also start to take off now, but none cause a general yellowing of the fields. Septoria is a common fungal disease that leaves brown, wavy, and yellow spots on leaves. Another thing that leaves fields looking a little ragged is winter damage on wheat that wasn't planted deep enough in the fall. If you are seeing some wheat yellowing in your fields and can't quite figure out why, please give me a call at 620-724-8233. This has been James Coover with your Extension Crop Report. Next up, we'll have Wendy Powell, Livestock Production Agent for the Wildcat District.
Hi, this is Wendy Powell, your Livestock Production Agent for the Wildcat Extension District. Fertilizer ratios indicate the percent of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium by weight in a particular fertilizer. Ratios are always given as the percent nitrogen, also called N, phosphorus, also known as P, followed by potassium, or K. For example, a 10-10-20 fertilizer contains 10% nitrogen, 10% phosphorus, and 20% potassium. Pulling out our producer calculator, this means that 100 pounds of this fertilizer will actually contain 10 pounds of nitrogen, 10 pounds of phosphorus, and 20 pounds of potassium. Nitrogen, or N, is critical for the maximum growth of grasses and associated with the plant's dark green color. Urea is the most common source in our area. It's only 46% nitrogen. Applying 100 pounds of urea to an acre will supply 46 pounds of N. Adequate phosphorus, or P, is crucial for stem strength and root growth. A soil test is necessary to determine how much P is needed. Diammonium phosphate, also known as DAP, can be applied directly to a pasture. Since DAP has a ratio of 18:46:0, applying 100 pounds supplies 46 pounds of P per acre, and to complicate fertilizer rate calculations, this same 100 pounds will also supply 18 pounds of nitrogen. Potassium, or K, is vital for disease resistance and winter hardiness. A soil test is needed to determine K requirements. Muriate of potash, commonly known as potash, has a ratio of 0:0:60. So, applying 100 pounds of potash supplies about 60 pounds of K per acre. Let's work through an example of phosphorus. Results are presented from K-State Soil Labs in parts per million, abbreviated as PPM. A soil test reveals there's 2 ppm in a fescue pasture, and optimum is 20 ppm. We use an equivalency factor to get that ppm converted to actual phosphorus, generalized as P2O5. Converting our known 2 ppm to actual P per acre, we find that an additional 55 pounds of actual phosphorus is needed in the soil. In reality, the fertilizer available is not pure P though, so we use DAP at 46%. 55 pounds divided by 46% is 120 pounds, so we have to apply at least 120 pounds of DAP to satisfy the phosphorus requirement for fescue. Since we have applied 120 pounds of DAP, we have to account for the 18% nitrogen in that, as it will impact our urea rate. 18% of 120 pounds is 21.5 pounds of N to the acre. We have to subtract this amount from the actual nitrogen needed. These concepts and common lingo can make rate calculations confusing. Feel free to give me a call to discuss options at the Labatt County Extension Office, 620-784-5337.
Thanks, Wendy. And now, here's David Skrantz, Natural Resource and Diversified Ag Agent, with her report.
This is David Skrantz, one of the Agriculture and Natural Resource Agents from the K-State Research and Extension Wildcat District of Crawford, Labatt, Montgomery, and Wilson Counties, with your K-State Research and Extension report. Many wildlife enthusiasts and avid hunters plant food plots to make their land more desirable for wildlife. What to plant in a food plot depends on what wildlife you want to attract and when you want to attract them. Food plots are typically planted for mourning dove, waterfowl, white-tailed deer, ring-necked pheasants, and wild turkey. Mourning doves will use many seed-producing plants such as wheat, millet, grain sorghum, corn, soybeans, and sunflowers. Corn and grain sorghum are particularly good for late-season hunting. Fallow wheat from a May-June harvest can be attractive for dove, although most grain is typically consumed before the September season opens. Newly planted wheat seed is attractive, but check local regulations with your conservation officer to ensure the field is considered legal to hunt. Millet and sunflower are excellent for early season hunting. Sunflower can be hard to grow if deer numbers are high. Soybeans are a good choice for those who want to provide both summer deer forage and a fall dove field. Be sure to plant a plot of at least 3 to 5 acres with soybean or sunflower if dove hunting is a consideration. All of these crops are often manipulated by mowing or burning just prior to or throughout the hunting season to increase their attractiveness to dove. Not only does manipulation make seed available on the ground, but dove require bare ground to forage. Dense litter on the ground will limit dove use of a field. A nearby water source and snags or power lines for loafing make the field even better. Many of the same plants also are good for waterfowl. Some of the more useful plants for white-tailed deer are wheat, various clovers, alfalfa, soybean, cowpeas, grain sorghum, and chicory. Choice of crop depends on whether you want to provide summer forage, early fall forage, or winter forage. It also will depend on the soil, the climate of the area, and the number of deer on the property. For example, soybean or cowpeas are excellent for providing summer forage and early fall bow hunting opportunities, but require a fair amount of moisture. Cowpeas are slightly more tolerant of grazing and may be a better choice for areas of high deer density. Alfalfa, grain sorghum, or chicory may be more drought tolerant and therefore require less water to grow. Grain sorghum does not provide summer forage, but is very attractive during the late fall. Alfalfa is a good choice for spring and fall forage, while chicory can provide forage throughout much of the warmer months of the year. Wheat and clovers are attractive during late fall through the spring. This has been a Damon Strauss with your K-State Research and Extension Report.
Thank you, Adavin. And now, here is Jesse Gilmore with his report.
With K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District, this is Jesse Gilmore bringing you this week's edition of the Hort Report. Spring is the time for the emergence of bulb flowers like daffodils, tulips, and crocuses. Based on landscape observations, daffodils appear to be the most popular spring bulb, but management on all of these species will be the same. Foliage should already have emerged by now, and most spring bulbs will have already flowered. These flowers will live for about 3 weeks and then begin to wilt, with the foliage wilting later in the growing season. Once the foliage wilts, it can be cut off at ground level, and the bulb will go dormant until next spring's growing season. All bulbs can live without leaves for a large portion of the year because of their modified stems, which swell to store water and nutrients to use in lean periods. While dead foliage will not harm the plant, cutting off and removing the dead foliage will keep your garden or yard tidy and reduce potential hosts for pathogens and bugs that could spread to other garden plants. Bulbs are just one type of modified stem. Tubers are another, and also function as a storage organ. One garden tuber is arguably the easiest garden plant to grow, the daylily. Daylilies are a summer-flowering tuber of the genus Hemerocallis and are arguably the most bred plant in history. Over 30,000 cultivars have been registered with the American Daylily Society, and more continue to be registered every year. One species of daylily is also known as the ditch lily, Hemerocallis fulva. You will see these orange blooms along roadsides and in ditches in June and July. Yellow cultivars of the daylily, specifically Stella d'Oro and Many Happy Returns, are the most common cultivars commercially available because they bloom multiple times a year. However, all daylilies will tolerate any environmental condition that isn't standing water and seem to thrive on neglect. This is one garden plant that you almost have to try to kill. Not all garden bulbs are desirable. People have been calling about wild onions in their yard and are wondering what they can do to control them. Wild onions, or any related allium species, can be identified based upon the scent of torn leaves. If it smells like onions, the wild bulbs are the issue. The problem people have with wild onions is that they grow exceptionally fast, outpacing the growth of nearby turf grass. This uneven growth becomes a nuisance for those desiring consistent-looking yards, especially if their yard is a warm season grass that is not currently in its active growing period. You can try to spray with a broadleaf selective herbicide like 2,4-D or triclopyr, but a waxy coating on the leaves makes this control method largely ineffective. The best way to control these nuisance plants is to dig plants out of the ground if there are a few, or to consistently mow until your lawn enters its active growing period or the bulbs are starved of nutrients and water. Wild onions can be used in the same way as chives, in cooking, but the bulbs are much smaller than garden onions, so don't dig up the plants expecting a substantial meal. For more information on today's topic, contact your local extension office. I can be reached at 620-724-8233 or by email at jr637@ksu.edu. Once again, this has been Jesse Gilmore bringing you this week's Hort Report.
Thank you, Jesse, and thank you for listening to K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District Ag Team on KGGF 690 Radio.